Our next speaker is Dr. Eric Silverfein. Dr. Silverfein is a surgical oncologist at the Baylor College of Medicine there in Houston, Texas. And his practice routinely involves the kind of cases where vascular compromise is just one wrong move away. And furthermore, as a senior surgeon, he's often approached by more junior surgeons in how to mitigate these situations when they arise. I'm thankful that Dr. Silverfein is here, and I'm looking forward to hearing about his experience talking about this is not looking so good, ischemic compromise during surgery. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Dr. Ghlani and Dr. Mawad for inviting me to speak here today and to the college for the privilege of the podium. I have no financial disclosures, but I need to disclose a few things. The cases that I'm going to present today from my institution, I've been given permission from the other surgeons. And as a talk like this about vascular complications in general surgery, we're not exactly looking to snap pictures in the middle of those cases. So a lot of the pictures I show today are drawings. And we all know that medical illustrators are optimists. So how did I end up here today? I am a fellowship-trained surgical oncologist. But you're not going to see a bunch of Kaplan-Meier curves, p-values. I'm not going to expand on elaborate molecular pathways of carcinogenesis. No fancy videos from the OR and exciting new techniques in tumor extraction. This is an experiential talk, and it's really arisen from the sorrowful contemplation of errors that I have seen and I've committed myself. So the famous author Doug Adams once said that human beings who are almost unique in having the ability to learn from the experience of others are also remarkable for their apparent disinclination to do so. So I would ask you and to take something from what we've all done, and we've all done it. So let me start with a case. This is a Tuesday morning in early March, my OR number 6. I'm finishing up with an elective cancer resection. I get paged to OR 8. The surgeon is doing a laparoscopic right colectomy for a cecal cancer, and they'd like me to come in and take a look at something. So I come to the OR, and one of the surgeons is grasping a large vascular structure with a laparoscopic instrument. There's a lot of large clips in the area, and the bowel is looking kind of dusky. Houston, we have a problem. Yes, we have a problem here. So my learning objectives are to identify three common operations performed by general surgeons which can be prone to major vascular injury, illustrate common and aberrant vascular anatomy inherent to these operations, review some of the pitfalls that can lead to vascular injuries, and discuss the management of vascular injuries related to these operations. If nothing else, I'm going to elicit some anxiety and palpitations and deja vu. We've all been there. Okay, this has happened to all of us. So in my world, the law of the land says that biology is king, selection is queen, and technical maneuvers are the prince and princesses, but I would say that the law of the land, when things aren't looking so good, like in this talk, anatomy and technical maneuvers are king. The queen and prince and princesses can save their biology and selection for another day. So let's start with case one, the unassuming cholecystectomy. So according to health grades, cholecystectomy is the most common operation performed by general surgeons. It can be performed, obviously, laparoscopically or open, and the complications during this procedure can be devastating. But knowledge of the common aberrant anatomy in this operation is key. And for any of those in the audience who are from Jefferson, they might recognize Nick Michel, who is very famous for describing the aberrant anatomy of the hepatic artery, among other things. So in 1966, he published a seminal paper where he classified the hepatic artery anatomy into 10 different types. And the takeaway from this is really that do I have a pointer here somewhere? Okay, if you flip a coin, you're going to end up with the anatomy that Netter says is the anatomy. But if you flip a coin, it's not going to be there 50% of the time. So during a cholecystectomy, unexpected encounter with a replaced or accessory right hepatic artery is where the damage comes. The problem is that you don't know you're there until you're really up close and personal with this artery. This artery passes lateral to the portal vein and lies posterior and lateral to the common bile duct behind the cystic duct and the hepatoduodenal ligament. And the knowledge of this anatomy is key. Unfortunately, most people don't get cross-sectional imaging before a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. But if you have a patient who's going for a lap or open cholecystectomy and they've had previous CAT scans, I would urge you to take a look at the anatomy. No surprises. This is just an angiogram showing the the path of the replaced right hepatic artery. And actually, right up here in this diagram is where it usually gets injured, right as you're dissecting the cystic duct and taking the gallbladder off the liver. So this is what I call the most feared cycle in gallbladder surgery. You have some kind of trouble in the porta hepatis. In this case, we're talking about bleeding from hepatic artery, either replaced or the normal anatomy. And then what happens is clip after clip get placed, and then that doesn't work, and then some sutures get thrown, and then you're back to trouble in the porta hepatis with some kind of bile duct injury, and this just keeps going on and on. So again, this is what it might look like, because nobody's actually snapping pictures when the hepatic artery is bleeding laparoscopically, but these are pictures from liver resections about what you might see if you actually injure that hepatic artery. The right lobe of the liver might become a little dusky. And this is what happens when they get referred to your center with the bile duct. After they've had an ERCP, you see that there's complete narrowing of the bile duct at the porta hepatis. So what do you do if you have a hepatic artery injury? Direct pressure until calm is restored. Simple things. Alert the anesthesiologist. We may have some bleeding here. Consider, if you're doing laparoscopically, converting to open, depending on your comfort with your laparoscopic skills or robotic skills. Bulldog clamps are nice if you're going to try to control this vessel. The hepatic artery is a very fragile vessel, and its branches are very fragile, and banging around on that vessel can injure the intima of that vessel, and it can dissect later. Repair the vessel, 5-0-6-0 proline. But your bailout option here is ligate it. You can ligate the hepatic artery. You can ligate the right hepatic artery. So one of the first papers that wrote about ligation of the hepatic artery was actually coming from Dr. Starzl in Colorado in 1964. He had a series of five patients that had injury to the hepatic artery or its branches. And what he did, he found that what happens is if you ligate that artery, you'll have some demarcation of the liver like I showed you. You'll get a transaminitis. You know, the AST and LT will probably go up in the thousands for a couple of days. You might even get a low-grade hyperbilirubinemia. But otherwise, it's not really fatal if the case is uncomplicated case. You have adequate liver perfusion by the portal vein, obviously, and some collaterals from the artery. This is a picture of a case of a planned. This is actually from a hepatic artery embolization for cancer. But you can see if you had a CAT scan after one of these operations, your right liver might actually be a little bit darker than the left liver. But you can see that there's actually collateral flow here, usually from the left hepatic artery. Let's go on to case number two, the right colectomy. Colectomies are still a very large part of a general surgeon's practice. It can be done minimally invasively or open. Fortunately, vascular complications are rare, but they're quite memorable and often morbid when they do occur. And as Dr. Anton was talking about, an ounce of prevention here might go a long way. So let's go to another case. Thursday morning, early June, this past year, I'm in between cases. I get paged to another OR10. They're doing an open right colectomy for a cecal mass that had prior perforation. They wanted to know and get my opinion on how much small bowel needed to be resected with this cancer. When I got in there, I saw a lot of proline and clips in the vicinity of the superior mesenteric vein. But they completed the right colectomy without any adverse events, and the patient went to the recovery. Well, at night, the patient was taken back to the operating room because they weren't doing so well, and there was concern that there might be some necrotic bowel, and when they got in there, this is what they saw. This is a picture, actually, of a Woods lamp looking at the small bowel, which is not looking so good. The colon looks pretty good. So the patient at that time was heparinized. The vascular consult, thank you, Dr. Galani, was called. And he performed a thrombectomy of the superior mesenteric vein with a patch venoplasty. I was looking through the operative note from the first operation, and as I said before, I have permission to show this. And this is what was dictated. While mobilizing the hepatic flexure, an injury was made in a large branch of the superior mesenteric vein. This was controlled and repaired with 5-0-proline, but in total, the estimated blood loss was about 600 milliliters. Just to give a follow-up, 3 days later, after the patient was taken back to close the fascia after the repair of the SMV, this is what the bowel looked like, and the patient did quite well. Great save. So what are the pitfalls during a right colectomy? Avulsion of one of these large collateral branches connecting the pancreatic duodenal vein with the middle colic vein or the SMV. And what happens is that the bleeding is very difficult to control when that happens. The vein retracts and it can't easily be isolated. So how do you avoid this? Avoiding excess upward and medial traction while mobilizing the hepatic flexure is best. Is this is either while you're doing it open or when you're doing it laparoscopically, medial to lateral, lateral to medial, but avoid that traction on that vein. Transillumination, if you're doing it open, of the mesocolon can help identify the arcades that are there, and there's a lot of variability in that anatomy. So what do you do if you have this problem? Keep calm and call Dr. Galani. Same principles, direct pressure until calm is restored. Alert the anesthesiologist. This is a lot of blood that's going to happen real quick here if you don't get it under control. But avoid frantically placing clips or suture until you can clearly see the injury. Convert to open. I don't care how good you are robotically, laparoscopically, this is a case you should convert to open. I'm going to talk a little bit about anatomic navigation, but using the same principles of proximal distal control and repairing the injury. So what is anatomic navigation? Look at this cute little tiger, right? If we're going to try to catch this tiger, we're going to go up to him and put him right in a cage? No. We're going to go from the outside in and trap him. Same principles. Navigate and dissect outside the disrupted anatomy. Find recognizable anatomy that you can see. Either the middle colic vein, the portal vein, even the first jejunal branch of the SMV. Tracing known anatomy back to the zone of damage. It's called the trail of safety. Move from one key landmark to the next without getting lost or causing iatrogenic injury. Don't forget the scissors. When my training, I was training under Dr. George Noon, and I was amazed that every time Dr. Noon got into bleeding, he didn't ask for suture, he didn't ask for clips, he didn't ask for the Bovie for sure, he asked for the scissors. And what did he do? He cut more to expose the injury, to see it, and then he put the sutures in it to fix it. So let's get a little bit more granular, getting out of trouble. Step one, digital pressure on the bleeding vessel. Step two, do a Coker maneuver or a Cattell-Brosch maneuver to relax the duodenum and the root of the mesentery. Step three, identify that middle colic vein or the gastroploic vein that traces back to the gastrocolic trunk of Henle. Step four, isolate the infrapancreatic superior mesenteric vein. The way I do it is go to the retroperitoneum on the border of the pancreas and widely incise that retroperitoneum along the length. Expose that vessel. Step five, manually compress the root of the small bowel mesentery proximal to the injury. Step six, trace back the proximal SMV and isolate that first jejunal branch on the right lateral SMV, a big source of bleeding. Step seven, identify the injury and perform thrombectomy if needed, heparinize if needed, and repair the injury. Try to avoid narrowing that vein. Third case is this, I'm going to call, this is not so looking so good 5 or 6 days later. So bowel anastomosis is inherent to any surgical practice. The principles are the same, open or minimally invasive. A failed anastomosis almost always has some kind of vascular component to it. An understanding of the vascular anatomy is critical with meticulous attention to technique. One of my mentors, Dan Albo, always used to say, good stuff to good stuff, tension free. So let's talk about the vascular anatomy of the colon. There are three major watershed areas here. The right colon, very vulnerable in low flow states. The marginal artery of Drummond over here is poorly developed in half of the population. The splenic flexure, or for the residents, Griffith's point, marginal artery of Drummond is absent in 5 to 10% of the patients. And there's a 2 to 3 centimeter area devoid of any vasorecta. These are danger areas. And the rectosigmoid junction, or pseudex point, distal to the last collateral connection with the proximal arteries. So what happens if this isn't looking so good in colon surgery, in the right colon? What does it matter? Well, if you're doing a ileocecectomy, that right colic artery branches off the ileocolic pedicle most of the time, or is absent, right? So you might think that you have good blood supply to that proximal colon if you're doing ileocecectomy, but you've actually taken that right colic artery and vein with the ileocolic pedicle. If you have a tumor or some kind of injury over in the proximal transverse colon, and you're thinking that you want to do an extended right colectomy, and you know from previous history the patient's a vascular path, well, that IMA might be occluded. It might have zero flow in it. So if you're thinking about doing an extended right in somebody that has no IMA flow, you've taken the right in the middle, your anastomosis is not going to do so well. So you might have to think about doing a transverse colectomy. How does this relate to splenic flexure at Griffith's point? When you're doing your left colectomy, obviously try to trace it back to, the way I do is trace it back to the most proximal artery, so there's good blood supply at that anastomosis. I see a lot of problems with people's colostomies. They die because the colostomy is put up there in that left upper quadrant of the splenic flexure where the blood flow is so poor, and then it dies a couple days later. What about rectosigmoid junction problems? It's hard for me to see, but when people say they're doing a sigmoid colectomy, they don't actually do a sigmoid colectomy. They take out a piece of the sigmoid and put the sigmoid back together with the sigmoid, which really jeopardizes the blood flow. If you're going to do a sigmoid colectomy, take it down to the rectum and take it up to the descending colon where the blood flow is better. In my world, doing low anterior resections, and I'm trying to think about putting somebody back together again, if their internal iliac arteries are occluded from vascular disease or any other problem, I have to think twice about putting that anastomosis because most of the blood supply is coming from those internal iliacs. These are things to look out for in your preoperative scans. So to review, I've identified three common operations that you guys perform that can be prone to major vascular injury. I've illustrated common and aberrant vascular anatomy inherent to these operations. I've reviewed the pitfalls that can lead to the vascular injuries and discussed the management of these injuries and hopefully elicited a little bit of anxiety and palpitations and maybe some deja vu. What are the take-home points? Ischemic compromise results in significant morbidity and mortality in general surgery. Knowledge of the common and aberrant anatomy is paramount, especially with relation to the hepatic artery, the root of the mesentery, and the watershed areas of the colon. An ounce of prevention. Review the vascular anatomy in your preoperative studies. They're all there. Everybody gets a CAT scan now in the emergency room when they come in. So the anatomy is there. It doesn't change. The porta hepatis and the root of the mesentery are tiger country. Vital structures are tightly packed together here with high-end real estate. Delicate anatomy is waiting for you to make a wrong move. Use anatomic navigation and the trail of safety, and learn from the experience of others. Thank you.